Europe is struggling to contain the spread of the coronavirus. Much of northern Italy has now gone into lockdown.
With a quarter of Italy's population in quarantine, economic and social life is grinding to a halt.
Financial markets took fright, with some of the biggest stock market falls on record.
At the New York Stock Exchange, it is an historic day of trading.
And fear and uncertainty is wreaking havoc.
We're looking at declines across the board.
Fear in this market, there's no other way to say it.
Crisis is the new normal. And how is it brought home to us? On the information superhighway, of course. The digital universe at our fingertips we all call the internet. But with every carefully conveyed official statement, every expert opinion, there are also the lies, fears, and sense of panic that spread virally across the internet. And sometimes, certain politicians, I'm afraid, join in.
Now the Democrats are politicizing the coronavirus. You know that, right? Coronavirus. Think of it. And this is their new hoax.
So how do we separate truth from lies? How do we turn the digital world into a tool of education, not misinformation? And how do we protect our democracies?
We have to fight against the ever-growing virus of fake news, which exposes our people to irrational fear.
Welcome to the Another Europe podcast with me, Luke Cooper. This is the final episode of Saving Europe from Itself, a six-part series from the Another Europe team, exploring the ideas that can show the way to a new and better future. It's also the 50th Another Europe podcast ever, not a bad milestone. We promised to have a big party for our 100th episode. On today's show, we're joined by Carl Miller, Research Director of the Centre for Analysis of Social Media at Demos and author of The Death of the Gods, The New Global Power Grab. His big idea to save Europe, 7 rules for digital hygiene.
There's only one thing that many of us have been able to think about over the last month. Yet Europe is really wrestling with two massive problems. Infection itself, of course, but also the cascades of economic and social panic that it causes. Now, I'm no expert in COVID-19, but over the last 10 years, I have studied how information moves from person to person. All seismic events now have equally huge digital aftermaths, I found, which always, at the same moment, provide both amazing and terrible information about what's going on. They make us both smarter and more stupid at exactly the same time. So whilst NHS web traffic has surged, and if you want to submerge yourself in data about Singaporean hospital submissions or maps of cases, you can, we're also seeing surges of misinformation. Miracle cures involving honey or garlic or conspiracy theories that it's all linked to 5G. A riot broke out in Ukraine after a fake email about evacuees went viral. Now, much of this is organic and unwitting, but some of it is deliberately concocted, possibly by states that want to drive societies apart. But the point here is that information is at its most dangerous just when it is also at its most important. Epidemics and infodemics go hand in hand every time. It was the same for Ebola, and it'll be the same for the next one too. This won't be the last big event that we all need to change our behaviour for, and it won't be the last time that we see clouds of online rumour and hoax, conspiracy theory and blame pouring onto the internet. So what do we do? Well, the good news that I have for you all is that the person at the heart of saving Europe and everyone in it is you. And me, of course, it's all of us. We're not the victims in all of these infodemics. We're a kind of willing prey, and we all need to change. So here's my suggestion to save Europe. 7 rules for digital hygiene. Think of them as the internet equivalent of sneezing into a tissue. Here we go. Rule 1. The information that wants to find you isn't the information you want to find. Actively look for the information you want. Don't let it find you wherever you are on the internet. Be active, not passive. Rule 2, beware the passive scroll. This is when you're prey to all the processes that can be gamed, the virals that can be shaped, the ways in which the online world can be manipulated to find you and to reach you. Rule 3, outrage is your biggest vulnerability to being manipulated online. I've looked at it across hundreds of different campaigns and found that it's always easy to fire, it usually spurs activity online, and it really helpfully makes the person on the opposing whatever social political side exists, outraged too. Rule 4, slow down. Pause before sharing. Give time for your rational thought processes to engage with what you're reading. Rule 5, Lean away from all the metrics that can be spoofed. Don't trust something just because it's popular, trending, or visible. Rule 6, on key pieces of information, health and diagnosis, of course, but also, say, where to vote, never just rely on information sourced from social media. Phone someone, look at offline cases too, triangulate analog and digital worlds together. And the golden rule, number 7, your attention is now both your most precious and coveted asset and also something which can harm you. Spend it wisely. Think of your information diet like your diet to have health consequences. It has health consequences for you and the people around you. Especially in infodemics, it's time to think about this.
So hi, Carl. Welcome to the show.
Hi there. Thanks for having me on.
Okay, so the current state of play with coronavirus, and I should say to listeners, we are not even recording close to live this one. So do check with public news channels for your latest information. But at the moment, we have just over 300 cases in the UK. There's 1,400 in France, and Italy is the most seriously afflicted European country with well over 7,000 cases. And as of last night, a countrywide lockdown and quarantine. So this is looking like an extremely serious public health emergency. And I think it is very difficult for any of us to talk about anything else at the moment. So we came onto the show today thinking about the digital world. And actually, this is like such an important part of this crisis, because as you say, you see two sides to it. You've got things like the amazing tool from Johns Hopkins University, where they're collating this information globally in real time and telling you how many cases there are country to country, and you can find it online. And so the internet absolutely doing its job of providing fantastic information. But then you have other examples at the same time of crazy infodemics, as you put it out there. So we'll come on to that in a moment. But before we get there, let's talk a bit about the state of play with coronavirus and particularly the preparedness of European governments for this.
Well, that's right. I mean, our voices are kind of echoing out to all the listeners now with what might seem like the distant yet near past. We're kind of living in a pre-apocalypse moment right now. I mean, clearly very serious, clearly cases spreading, clearly governments taking more concerted action, but still not that many cases per million in countries like the UK. Life continues rumbling onwards outside the window right now. The government has just not decided to go to the next stage from containment to delay. So we almost feel like we're waiting really for the cases to rise before we begin to intervene more heavily into the day-to-day life of people across the UK.
It raises this big question for democracy as well. I mean, China is both the positive and negative example here, isn't it? On the one hand, China, the police state, you know, par excellence globally, tried to cover up the outbreak initially, didn't do that, heroic doctors spoke out, realised they had a huge problem, but then on the other hand had the security capacity to quarantine huge parts of the country. And so, you know, there's this balance to be struck somewhere for democratic societies between how far you can go down that road to contain the crisis and how far that's actually infringing people's political liberties.
Right, and I think governments are trapped in this vice where it's a question of kind of doing bad and damaging things now to possibly avert bad and damaging things happening in the future. I mean, there are costs to all the interventions which are being made, massive economic and social costs. Locking down entire cities is not itself without cost. So yeah, everyone's having to kind of walk this tightrope. Obviously, it's all based on kind of a huge amount of conjecture and speculation as to what actually is going to happen to the virus, how fast it's going to spread and how it's going to affect people. And there's just so many question marks around all that. We're all of us who aren't kind of public health experts or epidemiologists kind of just nervously kind of watching what's happening within governments around Europe and the world to see how they decide how to best avert the costs, both viral or non-viral related.
One of the things this raises, you know, the rise of populism, the attack on expert evidence. I mean, if you're looking at a crisis like this and you've got Donald Trump in the United States that has described, as we heard in the introduction, you know, coronavirus as the latest hoax from the Democrats, and even Boris Johnson, who has engaged with certainly populist rhetoric.
We will not betray the people who sent us here. We will not
what they want to do.
People like Michael Gove, the public have had enough of experts. This is a situation where experts are absolutely essential to managing the crisis.
Yeah, I mean, like with all these things, there's this kind of double-edged lesson that we're all learning, which is on the one hand, like an absolute... with absolute clarity, the foregrounding of science and public health experts as being absolutely central to how we respond. I mean, everyone is just sending as many good vibes to the vaccine research teams around the world as they possibly can. Yet on the other, we're realizing the kind of, especially on the internet, of course, like the kind of creation of these huge kind of infrastructures of kind of mistrust and distrust in experts, which is kind of causing lots of people to turn away from all of that advice and the expertise which it offers.
Let's talk about how serious the infodemic around coronavirus is. There is the possibility of, you know, really serious viral panic. I noticed that the French government has even put out a series of public announcements that would be funny if they were not so worrying, because there are apparently fake news going around the internet saying that cocaine can protect you against the coronavirus, leading to the French government to point out this is this very dangerous and quite potentially addictive substance.
Yeah, and there was another conspiracy theorist that shared to over 100,000 followers that a drinking bleach would cure the virus as well. Yes. Drinking bleach. And that was a secret that Big Pharma doesn't want to tell you.
Jesus.
The point here is that these things aren't coming out of nowhere. Like, for decades now, we've seen, even pre, really, the rise of social media, we've seen these kind of alternative communities and structures of how to find the truth, how to validate it, emerging, which have had at their very heart a kind of a rejection of the kind of scientific method and of medical experts and what they regard to be the kind of hopelessly compromised network of Big Pharma and doctors and health professionals. You know, and they've been selling miracle cures, silver cures cancer, all the way now through to garlic cures or bleach cure coronavirus the whole way through. I mean, in a sense, really, monetizing miracle cures is the way that you actually make money from the huge distrust in experts which you've, as a conspiracy theorist, partly created.
Where does the conspiracy theorist temptation come from? Because, of course, there are perfectly good reasons to maybe be mistrustful of the pharmaceutical sector. There's obviously kind of a healthy skepticism. So how do we distinguish between, like, healthy skepticism of what we're hearing and mass, unhelpful, destabilizing conspiracy theory?
I mean, the first pamphlet I ever wrote at Demos was on conspiracy theories and its role in terrorism. And the pamphlet said, all terrorists are conspiracy theorists. And the conspiracy theorists thought I said, all conspiracy theorists are terrorists, which precipitated right. Years of debate between me and the conspiracy theory, especially the 9/11 truth movement here in the UK. I mean, I've always thought that you need to be sceptical of everything and weigh everything up to the equal standards of evidence wherever you find it. You know, some conspiracies are true. That is also true. The problem is when you kind of emerge into a world where there's a kind of knee-jerk cynicism with anything that emerges from any kind of mainstream source of authority, where you're not actually applying equal standards of evidence. You're immediately distrusting anything based on who's saying it.
Do we think in general that the internet and social media has undermined the quality of public discussion? You know, has it just got so dirty that we now have to do a deep clean of the internet to raise the quality of public discourse?
Well, that I have no idea outside of China what a deep clean of the internet might even look like. But I mean, it's doing both of these things in equal measure. So it's polluting, you know, it's polluting so many discussions and so many reactions to coronavirus just at the same time as it's providing all this amazing information. Clearly, there are some communities which are way more vulnerable, and communities which already have massive distrust in authority, the establishment, doctors, they're way more vulnerable to the kinds of messages which conspiracy theorists and others have been pushing, including illicit states and kind of hostile, kind of violent extremists and lots of other groups which have long sought to use the internet to try and, you know, undermine social cohesion and break societies apart. And we know, like, going back to this idea of digital aftermath, like, it doesn't really matter whether it's a coronavirus outbreak or whether it's a terrorist attack or whether it's a huge scandal in politics or an election. We know that there are these key moments where society can become very angry, Brexit's another great example where it's already divided on lots of social and political reasons. And those are the times when the internet becomes most useful to people that want to sow discord and undermine social order. And we are living through one of those moments right now.
So the most famous case of a cyber attack on the democratic process is obviously the 2016 American elections. I take it you think that Putin did it.
There's undoubtable evidence that Russia intervened in the 2016 election, and not just then. I mean, we've seen interventions by states in almost any election that you care to mention since then. We've seen, I think, a huge shift in the way in which the internet works and the relationship of states to the internet. States around the world, especially autocracies, but I think liberal democracies as well, have over the last 10 years or so all basically realised that information is not a tool of war. It's not something which happens within war. It's a theatre which war happens within. So air, sea, land, space and information. And they've all pivoted capabilities and strategies to how to fight in this new theatre, how to manoeuvre within it, how to dominate it, what weapons to build within it, what capabilities to develop within it. And we've seen, I mean, 2016 was only one example about states beginning to leverage those capabilities for various social political effects around the world. Like, it is now the theatre where most conflict happens within.
This claim that all terrorists are conspiracy theorists. Not all conspiracy theorists are terrorists, but all terrorists are conspiracy theorists.
Yes, that is a crucial distinction.
That's fascinating. I haven't heard it articulated like that before. But of course it makes sense, because if you have a kind of very unilinear worldview where there is evil and there is resistance, then that does lend itself to conspiracy thinking. Was that part of the argument?
Yeah, I mean, the argument was basically that conspiracy theories perform a number of like social, dynamical kind of benefits which lead groups to becoming violent extremists. They silence dissenting voices. So you can kind of portray any kind of like critics within the group as being, you know, CIA agents or the compromised kind of assets of whatever conspiracy is out to get you. They kind of are a spur to violence in the sense that they kind of lead groups towards thinking that something must be done. You know, we have to kind of commit spectacular acts that can kind of wake up a benighted mass of people.
Yeah, it's now or never.
Yeah, and they hive the group off. So we know that violent extremist groups like tend to try and isolate themselves from more mainstream kind of veins of either political or theological discussion, which can kind of lead them to go further and further and further away from, you know, accepted or mainstream kind of standards of kind of truth or religious belief. And conspiracy theories are a brilliant way of doing that. Of course, if you're the leader of a group, if you have kind of successfully argued to the members of the group that there's a conspiracy out to get you, well, that's a way of kind of isolating everyone else within the group from everyone outside of it. So it kind of fuels kind of us versus them narratives.
I suppose it's not a coincidence that in terms of the new extremist ideologies of the 21st century, particular ISIS, I mean, the internet's been a crucial mobilising theatre for their support, right? It's a very fertile ground for building and cohering and winning new supporters.
Well, that's right. So in the wake of that paper, there was this huge backlash from conspiracy theory communities in the UK. And we kind of realised, myself and colleagues, that they were mobilising much, much better than we were. This is around 2009. So it's kind of before Twitter really, really picked up and before Facebook was particularly widespread. But they were still using kind of all these forums and websites to like mobilise, to write hundreds of articles against the pamphlet, to turn up at events, to turn up at our office. And that was the kind of first wake-up call for us, that the internet was allowing kind of completely new forms of social and political organisation which didn't have to rely on anything to do with the mainstream, and therefore were benefiting all the groups that were the furthest away from the mainstream. It was happening actually on the kind of populist right at exactly the same time, and Demos at that point started looking at, around 2012, started looking at the rise of the kind of digital face of populism, basically arguing that populist groups across Europe were basically Facebook groups first with street-based wings.
That's really interesting. I mean, here one of the research projects we're working on at the LSE, we often make the argument that you can look into the public or digital spheres and you can use it to give you an idea of what's going to happen a little bit further into the future, either positively or negatively. And what you've just described is a perfect example of that argument, that this was basically showed Europe the way, and the West the way to its populist future.
We begin tonight with that breaking news, a horrific scene in Charlottesville, Virginia, a white nationalist rally that descended into deadly violence and chaos.
And to go back to your seven rules for digital hygiene, I thought slow down was such a good one and such an interesting one. I often think about the kind of frenetic speed of communications and interactions on the internet undermines my own concentration when I'm working on something, that you're sort of jumping between the kind of tyranny of multitasking. You sort of jump between different tasks rather than concentrate on one task. Do you think that this is a wider problem in terms of how users are engaging with the internet? And do you have any particular tips on what we can do about it?
All of these rules actually reflect much wider problems to do with both how the internet works and how we use it. Now, the reason I wrote them was because I was becoming dismayed with our general response to fake news and disinformation and misinformation and all these things, which broadly were to do with digital literacy. So all the advice is, oh, you need to triangulate sources, and you need to, which actually I admit is one of mine, but, you know, you need to become better readers of information, and you need to become more critical of the information you receive. That's not how online manipulation works. It really isn't how it works. Deliberate campaigns never try and change your mind. They just try and confirm it. They never try and dispute your fundamentally held points of view. They try and siphon them in new directions. They don't really try and change necessarily what you think at a rational level. They're much more interested in looking at how they can change the way that you feel. They work at levels of identity and grievance and outrage and kinship. They don't work at the level of rational argument. They prefer to run 10,000 campaigns doing all of this, each targeting a particular group, sometimes on polar opposites of any political spectrum that you care to imagine, and trying to exert influence that way. So digital literacy just doesn't work. So the point of these rules is to basically try and get to the behaviours which we know are being used and exploited by influence operators. And speed is one of the key ones. So I spent time in a viral ad agency. I'm fascinated by the idea that virals are in fact not these organic, chaotic things that emerge. They can be reliably manufactured and produced. I'm fascinated by this. And when you're kind of looking over the shoulder of like a viral advertiser as he's about to create his 100th viral, you'll know that he or she like looks at this kind of attribute, the information called ballast, which is basically like, if you can't get someone to laugh or cry or become angry and thump the desk at something within a second of them seeing it, it's not going to go. And that's normally because there's all this kind of ballast, the kind of complexity attached to the information which you need to cut away. So there too, that viral advertiser is not trying to kind of make an argument to you. They're trying to kind of hook into your primordial psychology, your very, very powerful base primordial psychological reactions to any piece of content, you know, cute, sexy, funny, angry, and get you to share it that way. So slowing down is like is basically an attempt to respond to this, to allow people to kind of get their more rational, more considered forms of thinking into gear before they just suddenly click on something and share it.
It's so interesting to hear that perspective, and you, because you gave the example of a commercial setting where it's been used, your description of how to capitalise on people's emotive psychology resonates with me from, I've heard that argument very strongly in the political world, right? The alt-right are famous for using these techniques, but of course, on the other hand, you know, Obama also pioneered a lot of these techniques in his successful presidential campaigns, using how quickly someone responds to something as a way of testing the extent to which they agree with it or it captures their emotional sensibility. And I often wonder around this, is the medium regressive in itself? Does the medium incline itself to a particular form of populism because it doesn't engage in a kind of deliberative, thoughtful, reflective way? Or is it really not? Don't blame the medium, blame the bad politics of those that are promoting racism and this kind of thing.
Well, to be honest, I mean, I blame all of us.
Right.
I do blame all of us. We are, and this is one of the main points I wanted to make today, is that we are not we cannot see ourselves as victims in all of this. We are willing participants. It's like someone shouting free beer and we're all saying we want free beer. You know, all of these online manipulation techniques like work with our cognitive biases. They work with our existing sense of grievances about the world. You are at your most manipulable when you're nodding your head, not when you're shaking it. So these work with, you know, these work with all of the things that make us most human, which, you know, are far away from this kind of beautiful rational actor model which economists have constructed for us and which has been demolished over the last 30 years anyway. Now, the medium is part of this, of course. All the social media platforms have created services which are frictionless. This is hugely important. If you're part of a kind of growth team at Facebook or Twitter, friction is hugely, hugely important. You think about friction all the time. Friction is kind of making anything more difficult, more onerous to do. So if you want people to do stuff, you take away friction as much as possible. And that means that the engineering in all these platforms is deliberately designed to make them really easy to join, really easy to do stuff, really easy to share stuff, not much information required. And of course, in frictionless environments like that, information transmission, it becomes much quicker, much easier to do. So they could sort the problem out, of course, just by simply delaying the transmission of information. You know, simply greying out a piece of information for 30 seconds before you're allowed to share it. But of course, that clashes with the basic incentives which every platform has to grow. And if one platform did that and none of the others did, that platform would diminish and die and go out of business. Politicians know all this, and moreover, and more specifically, professional digital campaigners know all this, and it's their pitches to politicians which create the campaigns that we see. But they're simply exploiting two facts, two realities, the realities of all of us as human beings and the realities of the services where we all live. So I see them as kind of natural reactions, really, to the kind of digital political habitat which every politician now finds himself within.
And that moves us quite nicely on to my next question, which is focused more on the book. I encourage listeners to go out and buy it, The Death of the Gods. I felt reading it that it has this big theme in it between a kind of dualism that, on the one hand, the internet is something that's quite anarchic, and on the other hand, the internet is something which is inclined to monopoly and oligarchy. So, you know, you describe kids that can go online, that write some clever code, and they can bring Amazon down potentially, crash the Pentagon, and they could carry out massive credit card fraud in seconds. You even describe some of the user interfaces that are very consumer facing, if you like, that you can buy online very cheaply to carry out massive frauds. So that's the anarchic side. But then obviously we also have the other side, which is the Facebook, which is Amazon, which is Google, you know, these huge monopolies that become information machines. Is there any room in between criminal anarchy and corporate monopoly for the good guys in all this?
Well, the book was perhaps rather unfashionably for its time and fairly optimistic, or at least it was determinedly not totally pessimistic about the reality we're stepping into. The underlying theme really is power, and in part the dualism that you were talking about is really the kind of competition between newer and older forms of power, and a very complex way in which they sometimes wrap up and compromise each other and appropriate each other. And the world is complex and there's no clear lines. But yeah, you're right. Like both seem to be happening at the same time. Everywhere you look, as kind of, you know, and this is a contention of the book, a lot of the places and people and institutions that we think of as powerful are far less powerful than we suppose. As these kind of hierarchies come tumbling down, all there's amazing new opportunities that are opening up for normal people to do good. So journalism is a great example, of course. Journalism is being denuded, it's being commercially emasculated. The kind of expensive, time-consuming kind of practice of actually holding power to account is becoming much more difficult to do by professional journalists as they kind of compete in this clicks economy. But at the same time, you've got all these citizen journalists. The one I wrote most about is Elliot Higgins and Bellingcat, who's broken some amazing stories, now able to do some of that job exactly because they are not journalists. Because they now have Elliot and Bellingcat and all these open source investigators that have done things like, you know, identify the people that shot down MH17, they identify the people, the Skripal assassins that committed the Salisbury poisoning. They have the one thing professional journalists do not have, which is simply time. They have time to kind of like spend going through that horrendous details-orientated task of turning, you know, the overload of the internet into you know, world-changing stories.
If only Zoe was here. Her little girl was ill today, so she couldn't make it, but she would definitely have something to say on the world of journalism. There does seem to be a changing relationship, potentially, between the consumer of news and the producer of news that is potentially quite positive in that environment, where users could become more involved through membership-like structures in saying, well, what kind of news do we want to have? What kind of internet do we want to have? Is that a potential model in the future?
That's right. I mean, and that's just one of many parts of our lives where we're seeing people breaking through, you know, in ways they could never have dreamed of in kind of the previous hierarchies which have existed to change the world for the better. I mean, another example is the Digital Democrat. So I go out to Taiwan to kind of interview Audrey Tang, the digital minister there, you know, and that's another example of how someone has gone from, well, in this case, Audrey Tang has gone from being a high school dropout to a Silicon Valley entrepreneur to a civic hacker to become the digital minister of Taiwan to probably being the first place in the world where digital democracy has had a really serious kind of impact, where they're now using a kind of combination of online and offline ways of decision making to actually draft new laws and regulations, which is kind of opening up entirely new ways for people to be involved in this sense, not just journalism, but the actual exercise of formal political power.
Amazing. This is very positive sort of good news kind of political vision story. So, you know, we can almost imagine like digital Switzerland's emerging, where we have very high levels of political participation. But that also needs to be combined with a deliberative component. I suppose on this podcast we've spent 2 years talking about Brexit, and you can never get anyone to say anything positive about referendums anymore. How do we create a kind of better deliberative space? If everyone's just an individual, how do they engage with the other individuals without just screaming at each other on an internet forum?
Well, the keystone platform used in what they call V-Taiwan is a platform called Polis. And Polis turns all the incentives and engineering of the platforms that we know, like Twitter and Facebook, on its head. So basically, in Polis, when you jump in to engage in online discussion, the statements which it makes most visible are the ones which are most consensual, not the ones which get the most engagement. So the trolls are basically banished. They're silenced. Polis constantly redraws maps of attitudes around a particular discussion. The most famous example is Uber. And then it only begins to show statements which have emerged, say, from the pro-Uber side, that at least half of the anti-Uber side also find something in common with. So it basically gamifies consensus. So, well, on Brexit, we were locked in to this kind of furious debate over, say, five or six really kind of keystone, you know, issues of contention and dissent for years without being able to find any way forward. The whole process which the Digital Democrats of Taiwan have created, in a sense, just sidesteps all of that and instead makes most visible the kind of 30 or 40, you know, otherwise submerged areas where we actually have quite a lot of in common with each other.
Yeah, that's brilliant. So that's what you need.
So it's a consensus-generating mechanism. It genuinely gamifies it.
Because if you'd asked 10 questions in the Brexit referendum rather than one polarising question, you would have probably got quite an interesting, nuanced set of responses, right? From a range of issues, from agriculture, fishing, free movement, you know, you name it. You could have asked a whole a la carte of like what options you want, and then it would have been up to our representatives to continue to talk to the public and think about, well, how do we get this to work, all of this quite contradictory set of public sensibilities about this issue. Whereas what populists have done is that they create polarization that they then capitalize on, right? So you almost need to polarize the public in order to run the Get Brexit Done general election, for example.
Yeah, and the other thing is crucially then how you link whatever deliberative exercise you're doing to power and to decisions. And to paraphrase the Digital Democrats, you know, you need to give it agenda setting power. So it's not just about asking someone a hard and baked question, especially if that question is a polarizing one. Instead, the whole process has to actually come up with the question that you're asking. So there's been times when they've rolled out V-Taiwan, where engagement from the public and experts and interest groups and everyone is basically invited to be involved, has completely changed the question at hand. So you don't have a kind of governmental mandate of a specific wording, which you then let people start arguing over. Agenda setting power, being able to kind of make the soup before the ingredients have been agreed upon, if you see what I mean, that's really, really crucial to the whole thing. Because quite often the consensus can be found in what actually is it really at stake here, rather than what the answer to the question really is. To give you one example, there was a weirdly furious debate in Taiwan about its time zone and about whether it should be changed to be closer to China or to keep it special. You know, and there's been like long-standing sides on that debate. But really the question was, how do we keep Taiwan special? Whether that was time zones or whether that was something completely different, the question was, how do we keep Taiwan special? The Uber debate really was, how do we encourage innovation at the same time as keeping passengers safe? Mm. Time and time again, there's an underlying submerged question to the one which is actually really being offered. And one of the kind of truly destabilizing and potentially optimism-provoking things that V-Taiwan has done is take that away from a kind of opaque and sometimes very distant-feeling political process and instead actually give the question setting as well as the answer giving to everyone involved in it.
That concludes the podcast for those listening on the podcast platforms. The podcast has had a fantastic 50 episodes, but there's much more to come. To help keep the podcast sustainable, we'd urge you to join the Another Europe is Possible campaign. Members of Another Europe get access to extra material as a benefit of supporting us. On this week's Extra Time, we discuss whether the coronavirus will end Donald Trump's chance of re-election. And as it's a special occasion, our 50th birthday, if you will, why not make us very happy and go to your podcast platform to leave us a rating or review? It really does make a big difference in helping the podcast reach new listeners and expand. Finally, if you like what you've heard and you want to learn more, we've also included some links to reading material on issues discussed on today's show. You can find it in the podcast description. We'll be back very soon. See you then. Ah, so thank you so much for coming on. We're now into extra time for the members. So do we think that this crisis has at least have one silver lining, that it makes it very difficult for Trump to win the next coming up in November American presidential election? I noticed that Bernie Sanders and is making a big thing that we need a president that believes in science. He's probably not going to win the nomination, but obviously Democrats are going to make that argument in general. Just a couple of months ago, he was looking quite good, Trump, to win. American economy doing well, supposedly. And now we've had those huge stock market crashes of this week. So it's the edifice of Trumpism in the US is suddenly starting to look a bit fragile as a result of coronavirus.
It is. I mean, to be honest, to put my own cards on the table, I mean, I think Trump should lose regardless of whether there's coronavirus or in fact anything else. But my big fear is that especially in the United States, coronavirus is already being interpreted on incredibly polarized and divisive grounds. So it's already being thrown out by the centre-right media as being a kind of new impeachment by the Democrats, and already actually, frankly, by the Democrats as somehow just coming down to Trump and his handling of it. You know, and that's what's really worrying, really, to go back to infodemics and epidemics and the role of the internet, is that there is probably no more important crisis for us to have a unified and cohesive response to than something like this. Mm. And if anything like what the projections say are going to happen is going to happen, we're in for a very, very rocky few months of division and scapegoating and fear and rumour and hoax. And I am just as worried about that and the kind of ripples of social and political unrest that will cause as I am about the infection itself.
Yeah, absolutely. And it exposes, on the one hand, our lack of cohesive politics nationally and globally, as you say. But I mean, it also exposes huge differences in public health capacity. I mean, America is particularly exposed with its, you know, you turn up at the doctor's with your credit card to pay if you don't either have insurance or Medicare. So, you know, you're that in a public health emergency, that's going to raise a huge issues for American citizens. You know, imagine like avoiding going to the doctor because you're showing symptoms of coronavirus, the implications of that in terms of spreading. It's quite terrifying in the US, isn't it?
Right. And it's terrifying. I mean, frankly, it's terrifying to be poor and ill in the States wherever you are and whether you have COVID-19 or not. It's also terrifying for many countries around the world that don't really have a health system for the middle class or the poor. But I just really, really hope, and this is an unachievable dream, that of all the problems, and there are many which we're facing, coronavirus just isn't one that we all hang our political hobby horse onto.
Yeah.
Hopefully this is just, I mean, I just really hope this is one where we can actually just respond to really as a population rather than as a series of political factions.
Well,
yeah, is that ever going to happen? Of course it's not.
Well, thanks so much for coming on the show. It's been so good to talk to you.